I have the duty to introduce the first speaker this morning. I heard a statement in Clearwater, Florida, at the Florida State Convention this past summer, that there are no strangers in AA, just friends that haven't met. And I met our first speaker for the first time last night and fell in love with her, as I do with all the women and most of the men. She didn't give me any instructions into how to introduce her, and keeping in mind that the chairman's duty is just to introduce and then sit down, I'd like to give to you at this time Bonnie L. from Paducah, Kentucky.
Good morning. I love the way you all say good morning. You know, for a once Yankee, that sounds very, very melodious to my ears, and I wish I could say it as charmingly as you do. My name is Bonnie, and it is customary at these gatherings to identify yourself as an alcoholic. I so identify myself. And you know, isn't it a bit much to ask a woman who has spent 30 years hiding her problem to get up here and tell all? But I'll try to do so. They tell me if you take a deep breath, it helps. And am I talking loud enough? That seems to be the major complaint. A little louder. That better? Can you hear me better now? Well, just wait till my vocal cords thaw out, and then you can move back. I'm going to try, as John read from our How It Works, to tell you what I was like. Having been sober for a few 24 hours, you know, sometimes it's a little difficult to remember what I was like. It doesn't seem sometimes as though it is quite the same person, and I really hope it's not. And I'm beginning to think that I have made a little progress from the person I was when I first met AA. I am a wife. My husband is with me this morning. Unfortunately, our daughter, who is on the program, could not come with us. You've missed a very rare treat. She is a lovely girl, a lovely Alateen, 18 years old. We have another daughter that's 22 and just recently presented us with a granddaughter. And we're very happy about that. Those of you that have had that pleasure and joy know how much it means to have a restored family again. But before I talk about my restored family, I'll try to give you a picture of what we were when we found AA, when we were blessed, as I like to call it. I was one of the alcoholics that had to go all the way to the bottom. My drinking could not have gotten any worse, because I was on the verge of death three or four times that the physician and my family felt that that was the end. And I know they may have been a little sad about the occasion, but by that time I think they would have been a little relieved also, because my drinking took over a period of many years. As I said, I drank for 30 years, and so you know I had to start rather young. At least I hope you think so. And I am 44 years old, and I like to say that to prove that I have the honesty part of the program. I was one of those females that was forever subtracting. And as one of my contemporaries in AA said, if I thought I looked it, I wouldn't tell you. And there is a little vanity there. And my husband keeps telling me I look younger than I did when I was an active alcoholic 15 years ago. So that, of course, is to encourage me to go on. He doesn't want me to stop. He likes what's happened since we've been in this program and active in it all the way. It's very difficult to know where to begin because my time is short this morning. I won't go into a blow-by-blow. But I would like to give you a picture of what made me ripe for an alcoholic. What the 12 steps have taught me about myself so that I can use what has happened to me to learn how to become a whole person, a normal person. Why I acted like I did, why I reacted like I did. I had to find the cause of my misery in order to cure it. And I think that's what the fourth step did for me. Many times I was told by my fellow AAs that one of the reasons that I didn't make the program when I came into AA was because I didn't dig deeply enough, or I wanted it too soon. Everyone had a different reason why Bonnie didn't make it. And they were all right. The patience that I am learning now, I was very far from having any part of it when I came into the program. And my drinking years were so long and so dreadful and so full of horror that it took me a lot of work to become whole and to be able to practice this program. When we first came to this country, I was very much uprooted. I didn't adjust. My parents divorced, and I found in my four-step inventory, I finally went back that far. That's where my problems began. My not being able to adjust to the things that happened to me as a young girl. Not being able to accept the aloneness that I felt in coming to a new country and all of a sudden not only leaving everything that was dear to me over there, but the little bit of family that came here, they separated. And I felt as an 8-year-old girl very much alone. I felt my parents were not very capable of giving me what I needed. They couldn't tell me anything about this country, and I had to find everything out for myself. I found there were the seeds of my destruction, because I learned very young to depend on myself and myself alone, no one else. This is what gave me the most trouble when I first came into AA, was turning my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. For so many years, I had depended on me, and by the way, my name is Hildegard. I had depended on Hildegard, changed that in a hurry, I got that Americanized too. So that now I'm Bonnie and I'm quite happy with it and it fits now. But for many years I had a great deal of pride. I was very fond of saying, I accomplished what I did on my own, I had no help from anyone. You've heard that before from AAs in various different ways. And this was me. I was arrogant, self-sufficient, independent. I never got any help from anyone and I didn't expect it and I didn't trust anyone. So with that attitude, I was seeking something, and when I was introduced to alcohol, that was it. Instead of developing further as an individual and growing into a mature adult, When I was in high school and met alcohol, that was the end of my search. That was my answer for many years to everything. If I needed courage or poise or any other thing under the sun, alcohol became it. I had a religious upbringing. I believed in God. But the minute I found alcohol, without realizing it at the time, I substituted alcohol for God. Instead of turning to God, as I had been taught to do as a youngster, and as I had many times when I was lonely, I now turned to alcohol. And from the time I was 14 and 15 years old, that was my God. That was my help. In any situation that I could not cope with, alcohol was it. All these things I did not know, I had to learn the hard way, and the 12 steps of AA taught me to understand my past in the light of what it did to me, so that by knowing myself, I could use the 12 steps to build on what God gave me, the things that I had pushed aside, that I had forgotten in my pursuit of alcohol and all the things that go with it, the good times, the false values that I had. There was only one place that I was a very smart alcoholic. When I dated the boys that had money in their pockets. They were freewheeling, free dealing, having a good time, you know, take me to all nice places. But when I really got serious, look who I picked. I wasn't that dumb. I didn't marry one of those freewheeling, free spending boys. And I didn't know how smart I was. I married a man that didn't drink, didn't smoke, didn't dance, didn't go to the nightclubs. All the things that, this is how paradoxical an alcoholic can be. All the things that I said I wanted, that I thought I wanted, and yet basically, when it came to something that was very important to me, because my parents had split up when I was young, the idea of marriage and a family and a future was very deeply important to me. So when it came to that, I got me the kind of man that I wanted for a husband for life and a father for my children. So I wasn't completely hopeless at that point. And how many times I have thanked God for leading me to Paul, because he stood by me all the very difficult years of my drinking. He helped me try to find an answer for this thing that had befallen us, that puzzled us for so many years. The wife that he had picked as a life mate, he was just as serious about marriage as I, turning into a hopeless, helpless, sodden alcoholic. When I think back on those years and what he endured, there are not words that can express my gratitude and my deep feeling of love and thankfulness that he had the patience and the tolerance and the love and understanding to stay with me, because I know without his help I would have been lost. And the many things that he feels so strongly about and that he did for me, he has good reason to. He learned it the hard way. He'll tell you that part of it himself. But one of the experiences that I had that I often bring out was one of the earlier fancy sanitariums he took me to, because it reminds me where I was, and it shows you where I was. Although it was what we term in AA a plush place, they still have certain places they have to put alcoholics like me. And it is a very simple device of keeping us unarmed. and that is to strap you to a bed by your hands and feet and put a strap. You know, I used to think they only put one through the middle. They put two. They put one across your hips and one across your chest. And to come to in that position, feeling as you know I did, and to look about me in the room, this is a picture I never want to forget, because that was one of my bottoms. The draperies were hanging from the walls, the lamps were broken, the chairs were overturned, and it puzzled me because I thought, well, how'd that happen? And then as I came to, as Jack, one of our good AA friends, says, twitch to, I realized that I must have done that. And just as I was trying to put things together and become alive again, somewhat, the door is thrown open and the nurse stands there with a group of nurses and interns or bodyguards or whatever you call them, attendants. And she states very emphatically, this is an alcoholic. That's quite a bottom for anyone to reach. And that was one of mine. I spent a great deal of time in that bed, restrained. And I tried to break those straps, because after the shame, the guilt, the horrors passed, I got angry. There was no place else for my emotions to go, so I got angry. And I managed to dent a few ribs on that strap, but it didn't break. And finally, when I'd worn myself out, evidently the doctor knew me pretty well. He came in and he sat by the bed and he told me, he said, you know, he says, you had convulsions when we put you in this bed. And he says, I don't give you many more, if any. And he says, you are getting a wet brain. And he told me exactly what a wet brain was, and it wasn't a pretty picture. I had wanted to die many times, but I think the one fear I had was losing my sanity completely, becoming not rational, not being able to think at all. I wanted to die, yes, but I didn't want to go insane. Don't ask me why. It just held a horror for me. And you would think after that experience that I would have been able to find, as Wes says it, you know, I love the way Wes says sobriety. I used to say sobriety, but you know, you can tell he loves that word. He just draws out every syllable, and I like that, sobriety. It has a lot of meaning for us, doesn't it? And one of the things that I first couldn't understand, you know, when I met AA, I was ready. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew that this was my answer. And when I finally got sobered up just a little bit, and as they asked me to talk, and this was after several years of sobriety, they didn't want me to tell how long it took me to get sober. And I couldn't understand that. I said, well, if I don't tell what happened to me, I can't talk. And they said, well, if somebody in the audience hears the fact that it took you 6 years, they'll get ideas. I said, you don't have to give an alcoholic ideas. They got them to spare. They've got a whole closet full. You know, you don't have to give. And it's a fact. I used to wonder why did it take me 6 years? After coming to my first AA meeting, I knew this was it. This was my answer. And of course, at first I blamed it on I couldn't get this easy does it. I couldn't get the 24 hours a day. I wanted it all at once. I had no patience. I couldn't control my temper, etc., etc., etc. You know, the whole bit. And then as I worked on each part of the program that I was told to work on, I think, well, now I'll get it. Revolving door. Now here comes Bonnie again. The miracle to me, believe me, folks, it's a miracle that I am here. Can you imagine for 6 years dragging yourself? Those of you that have had slips, that have had trouble, you know what an effort it is to come back. You folks that make it at the first time, you don't know what you're missing. Oh, that agony of coming back. That poor Paul, that light in his eye. This time she's going to make it. Yeah, that was it. In that 6 years, the longest period of continuous sobriety that I could manage was a little over 4 months. I don't know how I did it, because I didn't do it. That's the honest truth. I found that I didn't do it. I had help. Somebody up there wanted me to make it, because I sure wouldn't have made it on my own. And I was trying. I was trying from the very bottom of my bootstraps. I wanted it. And you know, there is nothing more maddening than to want something. You try everything everybody tells you, and it don't work. Talk about a feeling of hopelessness, of discouragement. This is where Paul came in. Just think, that man for 6 years kept telling me, "You're going to make it, Bonnie." I don't know why his mouth didn't freeze when he said that. Mine would have. I'd say, "Paul, I can't make it. I'm not going to make it. You make it." He'd say, "You're going to make it." I think, well, for him, all right, I'll try it again. You know, and then way down deep, but me too, I'll try again. And so back I'd go, and some of the fellas, "There she comes again." They'd head the other way, you know. I've tried everything with her. It's not going to work. But God bless those that would take another stab at Bonnie. "Well, try this." I tried it. And finally, I think the thing that did it for me, I had to have a deep spiritual experience before I could have my spiritual awakening. And so I had. That was given to me. It was one of the times when I was dying. This was my last drunk. 6 years of trying. You can imagine how I felt. And I had gotten to the point where I wanted to die. All along, every time I got to this very hopeless feeling, this "here I am drunk again, I think I'm better off dead, the family's better off dead," this time I knew I was going. I had a feeling, and all of a sudden I wanted to live. I said, "Just one more chance, God. One more chance." Imagine, after 6 years of chances, one more chance. I had the feeling. Those of you that have had it know what I mean. And those of you that haven't had it, you will, if you keep seeking. And I got my last chance. This is my last chance. And I know it. This is the reason I am so deeply, deeply grateful. This is the reason that AA means so much to me. I'm one of these people that I have my moments of deep joy, and I get around and I have a lot of fun in AA. I'm a happy person. But when I tell you about my part in AA, when I tell you about my gratitude, it's darn serious. And you know why? Because it's my last chance. And I have been given all this, all you friends, a new dignity in living. I'm no more a sodden, hopeless, helpless, wretched, female, and what a mess I was. Today I have new dignity. I feel it inside. It isn't something I put on with my makeup or my clothes or my hairdo like I used to. I was beautiful outside sometimes before alcoholism showed its dissipation on me. But I was never beautiful inside. And you know, now there are times I feel I'm absolutely scrumptious inside. And that's where it counts, you know. The heck with the rest of it. That inner beauty, that feeling of complete unity with people and the world, this is something that I feel I was worth almost dying to get. It was worth every bit of misery and heartache, and I couldn't have had it. I wouldn't have known what it was. It's this complete gratitude, this complete great to be alive feeling, this thanking God for this miserable person to go on and to try to share with you what I've been given. I don't say it very well, but believe me, I mean it from the bottom of my heart. I am a grateful alcoholic. I'm a happy alcoholic. And I love this way of life. And I know that as long as I'm useful in AA, as long as I practice my 12 steps, as long as I remember from whence I came, as long as I don't ever get that big shot itis that creeps over me every once in a while, it's, you know, that those three words that they repeat, cunning, baffling, and powerful. But you can believe it, because it just creeps up on you unawares. You, just about the time you think everything's going right with your world, you get that little halo slipping over one ear, you know, and it's time to go to work. I wanted to tell you, you know where I was and how I feel. The peculiar part of it is I got my AA in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And feeling as I did, when I moved down to Paducah, Kentucky, I thought, oh, this is not so good, you know. I had been in AA 3 years sober, and I was a little concerned about leaving those people that had gone through so much with me. You know, they knew all about me. Every little dirty detail. Because before I got my inventory to all to one person, poor soul, everybody had a piece of it, you know. And so they were real good to me. They gave me a lot of good advice when I moved, and they reminded me that I wasn't to go down there and tell them how to run the group, first of all. And I wasn't supposed to say, in Fort Wayne, we did it this way. They said that wouldn't make me very popular. So I tried to remember all those things. And then I remembered these stories they said about, you know, the Southerners don't take very kindly, the Yankees. And then I got scared. And I said, they're not going to like me. Well, they didn't. I got in the group, and I thought, well, see, I didn't, they were supposed to come to me. See, I was a newcomer. I forgot all about putting out your hand and smiling and being friendly. I thought, well, it's up to them to accept me in the group, you know, instead of making a way for myself. And besides, it was kind of a lot of effort to get to know people all over again. I didn't know if I wanted. And then Paul bought me a house. For 20 years, I told him that one of the reasons I drank is because I didn't like where we live. So he bought me a house. Beautiful house. I don't deserve it, really. I don't take care of it. I don't have time. And so, all of a sudden, I didn't go to meetings. I decided that this house, as long as I had been so good in AA and was sober all this time, I was going to give my family a beautiful home. And I mean, I worked. I rolled up my sleeves. I didn't put makeup on for weeks on end, and I worked. That house was just shining. Everything had to be just so. Then I decided that we ought to join the country club. You know, Our girls ought to have some of the advantages. And the folks, every once in a while, drop by from AA. I said, as soon as I get the house in order and I get everything settled, I'll be back. You know, I'm busy right now. As soon as I get this done or that done, there it went. I didn't recognize it at the time, but there was the beginning, almost, of my end. I started to get big shot-itis. We had a nice home, new community. The people in the neighborhood didn't know I was an alcoholic. Imagine me, of all people. Couldn't happen to me, you know, but it did. I almost lost that which I gave my life for. Just because I didn't want to make the effort to let people know me, I forgot to be humble. I forgot to go in there and ask their help. Instead, I came in with a chip on my shoulder. When it dawned on me one morning, when I was washing some of those dag-nab windows that look so pretty and are so hard to wash, where I was heading, I got myself down to that AA group and I sat there like a good little girl. And I listened to these people and what they had to say, and I just identified all over the place. You know, I'm back. This is Bonnie. Do with me what you will. Give me any job to do. I'll do dishes. But just let me be a part of the group. This is where my life is. Tech with a country club. Who needs it? You know, I don't. I haven't been near the place since we first moved down there. My daughters know how to make friends now. They've got them galore. AA's all over the place. They're coming out of the woodwork. Those are my kind of people. I don't feel right with the others. One bridge club has survived the whole thing. And, you know, it's kind of nice to keep in touch. It's only once a month. I can spare a few hours once a month. But it's kind of good to know how the other half lives. You know, you don't want to get completely out of touch. You have to kind of keep your hand in. You know, when my daughter comes home and tells me things, I have to know what's going on in the world. No, but all kidding aside, it's still startling how fast my mind will go back into the old groove. It was a warning for me that Bonnie that was is still under the surface. She'll still pop up if I don't watch. These steps are designed for me to use every day. I've never got it made, no matter how grateful I am or how happy I am. I can't stand still, as Wes said last night, and I found that out. I can't coast along on what I had, you know, this sobriety that I built up, and get something done, and then go back to it. I find that it's not very wise for me. I have to work at this every day. And then I deserve the right for this last chance I've been given. Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. God bless you and we love you. Appreciate you getting up and telling us this wonderful story. I never have chaired an Al-Anon meeting before. But I don't think, but I've got a little book that one time we were in New York called Living with the Alcoholic. We got this book and Dot and I took it around to Lois, and she autographed it for us, and she says to Dot and John, both AA and Al-Anon, because we're both married to alcoholics, so I guess that makes me an Al-Anon. But pardon me for breaking your anonymity. But it's a real pleasure to introduce this next speaker. And I do have a little joke that I said I was going to tell the other night, and I'm going to tell it now because it has some way it fits into this introduction, I think. Seems that there were three, and I stole this joke from Ray. Apologize to him. But it seems there were three girls that were applying for a job as airline stewardesses, and they had gone before this board to take the examination, and the board wanted to find out just what their attitude was toward the men. So they called them in separately, and they gave them a situation. They said, "We're going to give you a situation and a problem here. See how you solve it." Says, "Now you just imagine you've been flying in a plane and it's crashed in the ocean, and you're alone on a life raft, and you've got a paddle, and then you find yourself floating toward an island, and of course you're overjoyed when you see this island coming up, and you're afraid that you're lost out there in the ocean, and you see on this island about 25 or 30 men, and it turns out as you get closer they're U.S. Marines, and they've been there a year. And they haven't seen a woman, and they've got this look in their eyes. Now, what would you do?" One of them said, "Well, I would turn around and take that paddle and paddle as far as I could the other direction." So they took that answer. They got the next one in. Said, "You've heard the situation. How would you handle the problem?" She said, "Well, I carry a revolver with me, always have, to protect myself." And said, "If I got up there," said, I think I could take care of myself all right." So they called the third one in and said, "How would you do it?" Said, "You've heard the situation, and how would you handle the problem?" He said, "She says, I've heard the situation, but what's the problem?" I think she got the job. Seems that sometimes in AA you keep running into people. Dot and I have been around a little bit, and we came in and ran into Bonnie and Paul, first one place and another, and we've seen a little bit of them and got to know them a little bit better each time. And this is the first time that we have had time to really talk to them much and really know them. And then, of course, I've heard Bonnie talk before, but this is wonderful this morning what she did for me with this talk she made. And Paul has been a devoted member of the ancillary group in our fellowship, and I have enjoyed him, and I'm very happy this morning that we can all share the wonderful experiences of Paul L. from Paducah, Kentucky. Paul?
You want to stand up a minute before we start? Stretch? And I'm not going to do it anyway, but he said that somebody was asking about talking too long, and he says, "Well, I don't worry as long as they just look at their watches, but when they start shaking them, then it gets bad." I don't intend to do this. Down. Well, my name is Paul, and I'll say hi. Makes me feel good. And I'm a very proud member of Al-Anon, of the Paducah, Kentucky group. You know, sitting here, I was thinking about it. When I was in college, the professor came in one morning, and I don't know why this flashed back, but it did just now. And he said, "Gentlemen, this morning we're going to talk about Kentucky." And he stood there. He was a rather humorous old prof. He says, "Kentucky, where the corn is full of kernels, and the kernels are full of corn." I think after AA, though, it's been weeded down a little bit. Are there any men Al-Anon in here? If there are, brother, I'm awfully glad to see you. Man, I love it. 99% of the places I go, there's not another male member of Al-Anon in. And boy, I'm proud of Georgia in this area to have somebody. The identification, this, that I am the husband of an alcoholic, and I'm very proud of my alcoholic. You just heard her talk. You know, driving down here, coming through the beautiful countryside, I got thinking. I keep thinking too much, I guess, anyway. And the one thing that flashed back, and I made a couple of notes here about it, that maybe 100 years ago, down through the South, there might have been a pre-AA member. When somebody asked this person why he didn't drink, didn't he like whiskey? And the quote, which has come down through history, he said, "Whiskey, I like it. I always did, and that is the reason I never use it." I think you know I'm talking about General Robert E. Lee. I don't know if all of you, I imagine most of you people have heard that story. And thinking back maybe another 100 years prior to that, I think of another person in history that might have been an AA member from some of the quotes that he has come up with. And one is that it is easier to suppress the first desire than to satisfy all that follow it. I think that's pretty typical of AA. And another one that the same party said, "One today is worth two tomorrows." I think this one's a pretty good one for you, Doc. He says there are more old drunks than old doctors. You know who that is? Ben Franklin, back a few hundred years ago. I'm an envious bystander. And I participate in all the fringe benefits of AA. Now, when I say envious, I'm damn serious about this. I'd love to belong to AA. Believe me, I would. Like Bonnie said, I don't drink. I never had a drink in my life. This is ridiculous for me to get up here and talk to you. You know what it actually... I said this one time somewhere. I said, it's just like if they took some kid out of kindergarten and sent him down to the Cape to teach him how to run rockets. It's about as inadequate as I feel up here. The other thing that I enjoy coming down to an AA group or an Al-Anon group and talking, I do once in a while get out in industry. Here, I have that feeling, I don't give a darn, or you don't give a darn what I say. We all are together, we identify, and no matter what words I say, you know exactly what I'm going to say. I go to some industrial meeting and I feel that this bunch of cynics and people out there, now what's this big dumb son of a gun up there going to talk about? You know everything I'm going to say before I say it. You're still sitting here listening to me. Wes last night said it takes guts in AA. Boy, I agree. I wouldn't have had it, I'm afraid. And after watching Bonnie, I think this is the reason I wouldn't try it. And it's a real privilege for me to get up here and talk. Thank you, Bonnie, for making this privilege possible. She suffered, and well, I did too. And, you know, you can, when you look back, the humorous part now, we can laugh at these things, the horror and the tragedies back there. And boy, it was. When I look back at it, it hurts every once in a while when we try it. Now, you know, you call alcoholism the lonesome, the lonely sickness, the family disease. There was never a truer word spoken than that. Back in those years, I was the most lonesome person in the world, and Bonnie, I know, was too. We had these lost weekends, many, many of them. And since the last several years, I like to call them found weekends. Like getting up here and being able to tell of what happened to us. Back in those days, we were really starved for friends. We didn't have any friends. And now we've got so many friends around the country, I get amazed at it every time I come into a town. Thousands and thousands from coast to coast. I think I might run down here. I made a couple of notes about the qualified. I think Bonnie pretty well said this. What we were like, what happened, and what it is now. Follow the big book. I like this. We were married about in 1940. We just celebrated our 25th anniversary. And this is something that's rather a miracle in itself, because when we were married, everyone, and I mean 100%, said the marriage wouldn't last a year. So this makes me feel good to have this happen this way. I don't believe Bonnie was an alcoholic until sometime in the late 40s. And I can tie it back. I buy a lot of this physical part of alcoholism. And this sounds ridiculous too, but she developed an allergy when I think she became an alcoholic. And this was hay fever and some of the related type of sickness. Oh, at that time I was fighting something. I didn't know what the devil even the name of it was. All I knew that she was a drunk. And I was a frustrated, I was a mess. I was mad at the whole thing. And I couldn't do anything about it. I tried to. Man, I did everything that everybody else here that was wrong did. And incidentally, this is my own pet theory too, maybe you've heard it. I think that at the onset, at the beginning, many of us non-alcoholics, husband or wife, are the greatest stumbling block that the alcoholic has in trying to be sober. This is where Al-Anon enters the picture. And thank God for that. We started the hospital routine back in about 1951-52. I think we built a wing on Parkview up in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Bonnie was in and out there all the time. Sanitariums, rest homes, psychiatrists. I won't go into detail. Man, I could run and talk about those by the hour. I can remember one time just standing up here thinking and reminiscing. My mother was sick. She had diabetes. And they called me over to try to... We didn't know what it was at the time. And I was supposed to look at her foot. It was ulcerated. You could see the bone in there. And I couldn't stomach working on it. And Bonnie was half-loaded. She came with me, and she sat down and worked on that foot and called the doctor, and we had an amputation that saved my mother's life. This is... not an advantage of being drunk, no, but she did it. You know, I always like to say this. Bonnie used to take a drink every now and then to steady herself. And sometimes she got so steady she couldn't even move. You know, another one I always like to remember... too many alcoholics, and this is like Bonnie in those days, used to like to use four-letter words. Like don't, and nope, and won't, and can't, and something like this. You know, looking at her now, I'm prejudiced. I think she's beautiful. You wouldn't think of some of the things that happened to Bonnie. Falling downstairs, cracking ribs. I came home one time. She had her teeth through her lips. She had a broken nose, flat across her face. I think old Doc Swag did a real good job of patching you up all the time. I used to hate to go anywhere with Bonnie. And, you know, I buy this cunning, baffling, and powerful for alcoholism, alcoholic. I can remember how baffled I was all the time, but one story that I think illustrates how mixed up the other member of the family can be, I was going downtown at a banquet to give a short talk, and Bishop Pursley from the Fort Wayne Diocese was walking with me, and we were coming in to walk up to the speaker's table. He turned around, and if I remember right, he said something, "Oh, we're going to use the rostrum." I said, "No, I already used it on the way in." You talk about being mixed up. All I was thinking about was Bonnie Lane home drunk. Oh. You know, I have to travel a lot in my business. And I finally made a decision. This is after we got into Al-Anon. And we started Al-Anon in Fort Wayne, Indiana, I think it was about 1953, 52 or 53. And at that time, we met our mutual sponsors. This is John and Esther from Fort Wayne. He was, I class him, my sponsor in Al-Anon. And the reason I do this, he was in a year or so longer than I was at the AA meetings. And this one night, Bonnie and I and John and Esther went to an AA meeting, and we found it was a closed meeting, and we were banished or exiled to Siberia. We went over in another section of the house, and this is when we started our Al-Anon group. And I'm real glad we did. I can remember another thing. I think Wes last night, or I don't remember now, but somebody said about judging people. This is one that I can remember. I like it too. Esther went to a meeting up in Fort Wayne. This is in the late 40s. And John stayed home working, and the two members of AA brought her home this night. And John was telling me about it, that came in the kitchen, and he said, "John, in AA there's about 25% that don't make it, and we're afraid Esther's one of them." Now, you can imagine, he said that hit him in the stomach. He thought, oh my God, this is it. Now, the part that's pretty good about it, Esther, I think, has 16 years of sobriety behind her now. So don't ever judge anybody. The travels, I started to say, in going around the country, I made the decision, and I told Bonnie that if she wanted to drink, I would guarantee her that she would never run out of anything to drink. And along these lines, when I left town for a week trip, I used to leave with Diana. This was our youngest daughter at the time, about 7 years old, a little older. At least 6, 7, 8 fifths. And we had talked this over, the children and I, and I tried to explain, and I think they understood, that every morning before Diana went to school, she would give Mommy a fifth. Now, I was criticized and condemned for this, and I still think it was the right thing to do, because later a lot of people admitted that it was the right thing. A woman alcoholic can get into an awful mess going around trying to find something to drink. There's one story here, it's a little humorous. She one time was passed out on the couch downstairs, and I was sitting there working on some paperwork from the office. And she got up like she used to and wandered up the stairs and went to the bathroom, I guess. And I waited about 10 minutes, nobody, she didn't come downstairs, so I thought I'd go up and make sure she was in bed or something. You know, I searched that hole upstairs and I couldn't find her. This is pretty baffling. I looked under the beds, closets, everything, and couldn't no hide her hair of her. And in the bathroom, I finally noticed the screen was pushed out about so far. And outside the bathroom was a big peak roof, and up on top was another peak roof. It was an old, big, old-style house. And this top one was maybe 40-some foot high, say 40 feet. Now, I couldn't see her there, so I went downstairs and outside. It was maybe about midnight. And I'll be damned if Bonnie wasn't up there hanging on the chimney. Now I'll tell you the part that's baffling again. When I used to go up there and clean leaves on that house, had to use a ladder to get up. And she got up there, it was higher than I could reach. Now, I don't know how the devil, I don't think she even knows to this day how she got up there. Because it's absolutely physically impossible. So, I went downstairs, and I was all set the minute I heard the thud. I'd call the ambulance and I'd have the hospital alerted and the doctor and all this. I'm standing there by the phone waiting, and all of a sudden here comes Bonnie wandering downstairs and lays down again. You know, the pledge. Bonnie's Catholic, and she took the pledges so often I think she had it memorized. Now, this is nothing against the church, but she was sincere. She went over there, and she was sincere that this was going to be it, but she just couldn't do it. This was part of this 6-7 year period we went through. She had one other very annoying habit. Let's say in the middle of summer, if the windows were open, she'd get frustrated or something, and she'd start screaming like a calliope at 3 o'clock in the morning. You could hear her maybe a block away. And I know that I used to grab a pillow and put it over her mouth to keep this broadcast from going all over the neighborhood. And again, your insanity part, when I think back now, and it would have been so easy to keep that pillow on, and I would have gotten rid of all my troubles. I like to say that now. Oh, we went through lots of messes. If ever any of you have been to New York, the Holland Tunnel, we were going through the Holland Tunnel one time. Bonnie was loaded. She decided to get out of the car. Now, this is one of the few times I slugged Bonnie, and I slugged her good. And the only reason I did was to save our lives, because it's an awful situation with cars streaming by and under that Holland Tunnel, under the river. Another time we were coming back from Chicago, Route 30. I was going maybe 70 miles an hour. I thought she was passed out in the seat beside me. Out of a clear sky, she reaches over and grabs the wheel and yanks it hard. We go off through the ditch and through a cornfield. And thank God there were shallow ditches at that time. A mile or so either side, there were bridges and deep ditches. And all I did was through the cornfield and back up out on the road again. Now, only God has the answer why we weren't killed many, many times. It wasn't once, but this happened. I'm just illustrating a few of them. I used to call up when I traveled every night. I think always hoping that Bonnie would answer the phone, but I knew she wouldn't. And Diana would answer usually, and I'd talk to her for a while from a phone booth, usually by the side of the road. And then coming home, I used to just hate to come home. This last 75 miles, my stomach was in knots. I'd go up to that door. I didn't want to even open it. I always knew what I was going to find. It wasn't a very nice existence for our family. Bonnie had some other wild deals. She told me once, and this is before I knew better, she said if I had a pink Cadillac convertible, I could stay sober. And you know, I was going to hock my soul and get that, because at that time I was damn fool enough that I thought if that's going to keep her sober, we'll do it. She'd have been drunk in a week. Then another one that really floored me, she came home. I don't know if any of you ever have had alcoholics come home with some stories that you believe, but you know they're not true. You know damn well they're not true, but you believe them. She came in this time and she said, Paul, and I didn't know she'd had some drinks. I thought so. She says, I've got a new job. And I thought, oh man, now what? who'd hire her? She says, yes, I'm going to be a hostess on a world's cruise. Ooh. Well, for about 2 weeks, I worried like the devil that she was going to be disappearing and she was going on this world's cruise as a hostess, an alcoholic. Oh, man. Oh, she tried to jump off the porch. There was all kinds of alibis and cut wrists. She's cut her wrists, everything. Then all of a sudden, I'd like to call this the miracle happened in our family. And this was back in 1958. And at that time, it was August 20th. It's a date that's indelible in my mind. Bonnie stayed sober a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. I don't know about the rest of you, but I was waiting for it to happen. I was sure. You know, after 6-7 years, you get pretty sure of this. And it didn't. All of a sudden, a year. And she got her yearly token. And I think this is when I started to believe that we were on the way, that we had accomplished something. I say we, because in my books, alcoholism is a family disease, and that we all have to work it together. I think it's a real tough situation when an alcoholic has to come to AA on his own and his wife stays home and doesn't get all of the benefits that she should get by going along with him hand in hand. There's a couple of trick sayings I've seen over the years, and I like these, that it's a heck of a situation when two people are at odds and they both keep trying to get even. Now, this is pre-AA and pre-Al-Anon. I'm pretty sure everyone will agree to that. And then another one, that the more we grow up, the less we blow up. And this is after you get into AA, Al-Anon. And when you're wrong, promptly admit it. The first time this happened with Bonnie, you could have knocked me over with a feather. She'd never did it in her life before. Never. We had the usual, I was going to say discussion. It was a damn good fight. Let's put it this way. And she stormed out of the room. And this meant that normally we wouldn't talk for a day or so. In about 3-4 minutes, she walked back in. I think she'd been sober about 6 months. And she said, "Paul, I'm sorry, I'm wrong." Wow. Now, she taught me something. And I've been trying to do that ever since, too. I do it in business. When you're wrong, admit it. And some of these characters that work for me, they can't understand it. The boss all of a sudden, "Man, I'm goofed, I'm the dummy." Makes me feel good, though. I think it's a good way to do it. The purpose of Al-Anon, there's only one primary purpose as far as I'm concerned, and it's in the book, and that is the Al-Anon family group has but one purpose, the help of families of alcoholics who still suffer. And this is what we try to do. Now, you members of AA, I think this can apply to you as well as to Al-Anon, that there's three very, very important things we never do or never should ever do. Number one, I don't think we should get involved in religious denomination discussions. This is not part of AA or Al-Anon. Number two is gossip. That's deadly. If anybody starts gossiping in our group, we shut them up fast. I think everybody should do that. And number three is dictatorships. That's no good. We don't have it, thank God for that. The family disease, I had a couple of incidents happen to me. I'd like to mention them to you. I think it illustrates some of the Alateen or children of alcoholics. You know, many times the alcoholic will say, "I hurt nobody but myself with my drinking." But I was over in Louisville, Kentucky, in a meeting similar to this, and down here in the front row was a young girl, I'd say maybe 11 years old, not any older than that. And after the meeting, we were all sitting around outside having coffee, and this youngster came up and tapped me on the shoulder and wanted to know if she could talk with me. Said, "Fine." And there was a bunch of Al-Anon women sitting there. We were all talking, and she sat down and joined us. And she started to tell us what she was doing to help her father. Her father, incidentally, was drinking at that time. She was Catholic. The numerous novenas, the devotions, the masses that she was going to help her dad to be sober. But the one that hit us all between the eyes like a ton of bricks, and I'm an emotional person, I'm not ashamed to cry, was that, and all the girls left me with her alone because they couldn't take it. She said that at church she had stolen some holy water and put it in her father's whiskey. It might help him to be sober. Well, it got me here, and it did everybody else. Another one that happened, and this was told to me. I wasn't engaged in this myself, but a member of Al-Anon told me that, again, her young daughter came home from school, and she had a package of cigarettes in her purse. And, of course, her mother would raise Cain. This is what we all would do. What do you mean by smoking at this age and so forth? And the little girl turned around to her and she says, "No, Mommy, you've got it wrong." She says, "I used what I had left over from my lunch money this week, and I bought this package of cigarettes because maybe tonight Daddy won't have to go out and get some cigarettes." Doesn't affect the family? Oh, man. It did me, and it does everybody else. You Alateens know what I mean. I'm sure you do. The alcoholism is a progressive disease. I buy this wholeheartedly. But also, I feel that our sobriety, our mutual sobriety, has to be progressive too. We can't stand still. We have to keep working at it and going ahead together. This falling behind, I just hate to see it. I said it a little while ago. And I only wish that we could some way convey to those wives and husbands, and that's why I'm so glad to see you fellas back there, what it means for the family to work this whole program together. It's living. I told Bonnie downstairs in the coffee shop, incidentally, I'm scared to death. I don't know if you know this or not. I may not look like it. But I used to be in football, and I was played national championship golf and stuff. I was never as scared then as I am now. I told Bonnie downstairs, and I think a lot of you fellows and women feel the same way, I said, "Now I think you're prettier than the day I married you, and I know that you're a much better person." I say this from the bottom of my heart. I was riding on the road again, you know, me and my riding all the time. I heard a radio program, and you've all heard it, and I think the song was "You'll Never Walk Alone." I think this is a wonderful theme song for AA. Because once you get into AA and Al-Anon, you'll never walk alone. You'll always have somebody with you, behind you, ahead of you, and helping you. I had it. You folks have had it. We've got a lot more coming in behind that we're going to do the same thing to. You know, I'm getting too damn serious here. Doc, you'll appreciate this, and I don't know if you ever did it, but I saw this little joke one time, and now I've got a chance to use it with a doctor present, that this doctor was, say, a semi-alcoholic. Oh, let's be generous. He wasn't an alcoholic. And he used to take several highballs before dinner, and he had this emergency call that one of his patients had injured her wrist very badly, and would he come right over? Well, the doc knew that these people he was supposed to call on were strict teetotalers. And this was a mess because he was smelling like a brewery or a distillery. So I give him credit. He was one of the fastest thinkers in my books I've ever seen. He said that, did they have any whiskey in the house for medicinal purposes? I said, yes. So he directed that they use it in massaging the wrist for 20 minutes before he got there. One to you. That's real cover up, isn't it? This letting go of an alcoholic, it was hard for me to do. I used to try to run Bonnie's life. Then, when I did, and finally learned something, this is, I think, when we progressed a wee bit, and in my feeble way, I helped her a little bit from then on. Now, I read an article, and it was titled, Let Go and Hold. I don't know if any of you have ever read this. You can see that I'm quite a reader. And what it was, and this wise old professor demonstrated it, that he said, hold out your hand and picture a little bird sitting in the palm of your hand. And if you just curl your fingers, even slightly, toward this bird, he's going to flutter and want to escape. Now, if you leave your palm open flat and don't attempt to hold the bird, what's the result? The bird stays there. You've seen this all the time. He's quiet, he's secure in his freedom with you, as long as you make no motion to restrain him. I think it applies just as well to us members of Al-Anon and in AA. One thing here I dug up, it was in one of my files at home. Bonnie wanted to know if she could have it. I'm going to give it to her today. I said, no, not until I use it. This was 1962. Patty, our oldest daughter, who hated Bonnie when she was drinking. She would have no part of her. And we thought that Bonnie would never get her love back at all. Gave her this little card. It came in the mail. And it said, Mother, those who bring sunshine into the lives of others cannot keep it from themselves. And you can have it now, Mom. It's yours. She didn't know I had it. I've saved a lot of these things. I've saved other things that I never would want to show to Bonnie. Things like wills, weird wills, and asking for forgiveness when she tried to commit suicide. These type of things. I think I should burn them sometime soon. You know, in talking, I heard another saying one time. I don't know where it was. And when I get up, I try to remember this, that the forest would be very quiet if all the birds were quiet except the best singers. So we get up and we try to do our best, feeble though it may be. The one thing that came, and this I'd like to close with, I got this from somebody out in California, and it hit me between the eyes. And the title is How It Works. I don't know if any of you have ever heard this. I hadn't until I received it recently. It was written, I think, by a woman member of AA, and I feel that it applies to Bonnie just about right to a T. And it reads, utter confusion, misery, and pain. Humiliation, remorseful, ashamed. Dreading to face the light of each day, not wanting to hear what people would say. Like, where is your willpower? Where is your pride? They don't understand that deep down inside, I wished I knew the answers to give and how to find the courage to live. I had taken the pills they told me I should. I tried all the cures, but they did no good. I made many promises and meant them too, but the compulsion to drink is stronger than you. One day a friend happened to say, I know the answer, I can show you the way. All it takes is an open mind, believe what you hear from your own kind. I went to a meeting, they read chapter 5. The steps made some sense and hope was revived. I saw living proof of what faith can do. It worked for them, why not for you? One day at a time, they told me to live. They said, easy does it and learn to forgive. Be humble, be honest, and help when you can. I heard them repeat the Serenity Prayer and soon realized all my answers were there. Now, when someone asks, can miracles be? May I always reply, take a look at me. The benefits we've got, our family, I've got a wife I never thought I'd have. The doctor gave up that she'd be dead three times. He told me this three times. I think that the worst day we can have now, the worst possible day, is still pretty doggone good. And all I can say is just thank God for AA.